Morning, welcome to your Third Court of Appeals. We have two cases being argued as one this morning, so we'll get right to it. I'm going to go ahead and call both cases for purposes of the record. As you may know, if you've argued recently, we now have an audio recording system, and so there will be an audio recording made of the arguments, which you will then be able to go back later and look at on the website, and hopefully that recording will not be used for any further proceedings, given the nature of the way this thing seems to be going. Court will call Stacy Hammer versus University Federal Credit Union, cause number 18042CV, and also Inway Raggio 2204 Jesse Owens, cause number 18213CV. For those of you new to the Third Court, each side is given 20 minutes to argue. As I understand, you all have gotten with our clerk as far as your time allotment, and I think we have four lawyers arguing. Is that correct? Okay, and to help me keep track, if you would please, when you stand up, give me your name and who you represent as you argue, just because we do have sort of an unusual alignment in the case. We have a time warning system. When the yellow light goes off, you have 2 minutes left. When the red light goes off, your time has expired, and so you need to wrap up the thoughts you're having and look to the court for further guidance as to whether to continue or not. By way of housekeeping, if anyone in the audience has a cell phone, pager, or other device that might go off and disturb the litigants, now's a good time to reach down and turn it off. And with that, we will hear from the attorneys. Starting with, if I'm correct, is it Mr. Barrera going first?
Actually, I'm Mr. Barrera. I represent the appellant, Stacy Hammer, but Jerry Rios will go first.
Okay, see, I'm messing up already. So you guys, I'll trust you to run yourselves.
No problem, mate. May it please the court.
My name is Jerry Rios. I'm the attorney for the relator, Raggio. Excuse me, Raggio 2204 Jesse Owens LLC. Now, I filed this mandamus and just wanted to go over some of the key points in the mandamus. It is our belief that the trial court abused its discretion when it granted Mr. Sutton's motion to distribute the funds that were in that were actually the proceeds of the sale of the LLC's sole property. Now, as I explained in our brief, it is undisputed that my client was the owner of the real property at issue, and that property was improperly seized by Mr. Sutton. Our position is that Sutton erroneously stated the law regarding LLCs and tax forfeitures and how they interact there. Sutton convinced the trial court that the ownership of the entity's sole asset was somehow transferred to Stacy Hammer simply because the tax forfeiture event that happened in August of 2014. Sutton and Morgan both stipulate that Sutton somehow proved that Hammer was the successor in title or ownership of the LLC's sole asset. Excuse me. Sutton and Morgan both stipulate that Sutton somehow proved that Hammer was the successor in title or ownership of the LLC's asset because Sutton allegedly proved that Hammer was the sole member of the LLC. And because of her allegedly being the sole member, then she somehow also personally owned the asset in question.
Was ownership really an issue? I mean, wasn't on a turnover order, isn't the issue really possession or control?
I think ownership is an issue. Possession, as is being now argued by Sutton, is not the sole determination. And so if Ms. Hammer had possession of the property and she was, for example, a manager of an LLC or a property manager, if you want to take that one step further away from ownership, that did not mean that the property was hers to dispose of as she saw fit or to be taken from her as a third party would see fit. So that was an issue, and that's really our primary issue.
What was the argument made at the turnover hearing to Judge Livingston that the underlying order was questionable because it was obtained by nunk-pro-tunk?
Because it was obtained, I'm confused.
Well, the order being enforced is the order nunk-pro-tunk, correct?
The nunk-pro-tunk happened at a later date with a different judge.
Right.
And so the argument would have been not to Livingston.
That's right. Okay. That's right. My mistake.
No problem.
Okay.
But I guess if there's a question there, I'm happy to answer it.
No, it was based on a mistaken assumption on my part, so.
Okay, no problem.
Proceed.
Okay, then, let's see.
Maybe a timeline of the various orders would be helpful, because I was thinking that the nunk-pro-tunk came along, and then there was the order, and then there was the turnover order. Is that not the correct order?
So the nunk-pro-tunk happened at the very end. Okay, that's the most recent order that was signed by the trial court. So there's two orders at issue in the underlying case, which is a UFCU case, is what we call it on our end. And so UFCU, certain defendants obtained a summary judgment, and that was back in 2016, August 18, 2016. And that is the order that was determined by this court to be the final judgment. Now, subsequent to that order, litigation continued. And I can't tell you exactly how it happened. I wasn't personally involved in the case, but basically there was a granting of a motion for sanctions against Stacey Hammer in that underlying case. And that happened in 2016. At that time, an order was granted for sanctions and attorney's fees in favor of Morgan, one of the sole remaining defendant in that case. The post-judgment activity happened with Sutton being appointed as the receiver in the case, and one of the first actions that Sutton took was to determine, he says several times that he proved that Stacey Hammer was actually the person in control or possession of the property. Yet looking back at the record and being involved from that point forward, I don't remember any evidence being made there. So one of the key things that I think this court should know is that there was an assumption that was made by Sutton. And that assumption was that because there was a sole member for an LLC that suffered a tax forfeiture, that somehow Stacey Hammer was now the sole owner of the property. And it just doesn't make any sense.
If you could go back to the timeline just for a second.
Sure.
So when this court issued its mandate saying that the sanctions order was void.
It's March of 2017.
Right. What was the status of the collection proceedings at that point?
Say that again, the status.
What was the status of the collection proceeding at that point?
At that point, the property had already been sold, the real property. The money was in the registry of the court, of the Travis County Court, and Stacey Hammer had filed for personal bankruptcy in her new domicile, which is Colorado. And so at that time, there was money being held in two separate places pending a resolution. And one of them, again, was Travis County. That was the majority of the money that was earmarked to go to Sutton and to Morgan. And then the remaining balance, which was basically the excess proceeds, was in the registry of the Colorado Bankruptcy Court and is still there. And so that money that's in the Colorado Bankruptcy Court was actually ordered by the trial judge in Travis County to be paid to the LLC. But what happened in that case, and maybe Mr. Sutton can give you some insight into this, that money was actually, instead of being sent to the LLC, was sent to the bankruptcy trustee in Colorado for Ms. Hammer's personal bankruptcy. Didn't make a lot of sense to me, and apparently Sutton and Morgan are fighting in the bankruptcy court, I believe, to obtain some of that money. I'm not sure what their basis is for having any entitlement to that, but that is ongoing, and you've probably seen some argument on that case.
And are there still funds in the registry in Travis County?
There should be. I have no knowledge of any money being dispersed. Now, the LLC actually had two owners. And my point was that the evidence that was allegedly presented by Sutton to the trial court was that Stacey Hammer was the sole owner. And I believe he made this statement by reviewing the documents and records that are available online regarding the Texas Secretary of State. And now, one thing that's important to remember, when you have an LLC or a corporation, anytime you have ownership interest there, whether it's the original ownership interest or shares that have been transferred or sold or however they may be conveyed, That's a private event. That's not necessarily a public event. And that in a closely held company or a single or dual member LLC such as this, that happens behind the scenes. There's no public filing. There's no public disclosure that's made as to who the owners are. It can be made at the very beginning when an entity is filed, such as an LLC. You can go through and file what would be a member-managed LLC. And at that point, the public would know who the members are, at least who the members are that can manage the company. And so I believe Sutton is relying on that filing and on that fact to say that Hammer was the only member. When in fact, prior to the tax forfeiture, if Sutton had done any investigation, which he had not, as to who the ownership actually belonged to, when that would have been a post-judgment deposition or discovery, he would have found out that Donna Gregory was a 50% owner of the LLC at that time. Donna Gregory is a sister of Stacey Hammer, and she's here in the court today. And Donna Gregory became an owner of the LLC because after the divorce of Stacey Hammer, she lent money to Stacey Hammer and lent money to her sister. And as part of that loan, she required collateral. And the only collateral that I believe that Stacey Hammer had at the time and was able to put up for the loan was an ownership interest in the LLC because it owned the property free and clear. And apparently that was sufficient. But again, prior to the tax forfeiture, there were two owners of the LLC. And so there really is no reason to state that because Stacey Hammer controlled the property, in this case she would have acted as a property manager, so she controlled the property that belonged to the LLC, that she was also somehow personally an owner of that same property that was subject to seizure or forfeiture by Patrick Sutton.
I could be missing something, but why isn't your best argument that as soon as we ruled, the sanctions order became void and it's no longer collectible? And that if Elizondo applies, which it does because it's the highest court in Texas, then it's no longer collectible. And why isn't your argument that we deserve mandamus because they're trying to collect a void order?
Well, Elizondo didn't exist at the original time. I believe Elizondo was decided a few months ago.
Right.
And quite honestly, that doesn't answer the ultimate issue that we were seeking to get an order from this court on, which is that a LLC's property cannot be taken from it because of the debt of one of its owners.
And then that's your argument as to how the trial court abused its discretion.
That's exactly right. Now, the Elizondo case, of course, is overarching and I think controls, as you are alluding to.
So do we need to reach that issue in light of Elizondo?
In light of Elizondo, no.
That was my question. Right?
That's exactly right.
Okay.
And I believe I'm out of time.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Barrera.
Good morning. May it please the court. I represent appellant Stacey Hammer, and we are here today because the appellee, Wayne Morgan, did not abide by this court's judgment of March 30th, 2017, that the January 12th, 2016 sanctions order is void. Morgan challenged this court's judgment by filing two motions for rehearing. This court denied those motions. Morgan had an opportunity to file a petition for review in the Supreme Court, but he did not. That means this court's judgment of March 30th, 2017 is final. And that held that the sanctions order is void. Instead of pursuing appellate remedies, Morgan went back to the trial court for an order deleting the finality phrase from the trial court's order that this court rested its decision on.
We don't have a reporter's record from that hearing on the nut-pro-tunk. Did Judge Soifer have our opinion in front of her?
Excellent question, Your Honor. I was going to actually raise that I do not know because I was not at that hearing. If you'd like, I can see if there is a reporter's record and supplement the record in this appeal. There's no question Morgan was aware of this court's opinion. He challenged it in two motions for rehearing. Whether Judge Soifer was aware that the effect of what she was asked to do would be to undermine and delete the language that this court relied on, I don't know the answer to that.
Okay. No need to supplement the record on that.
Okay. There's no question that Morgan's actions in the trial court had the purpose of circumventing this court's decision, which was final at that point because it wasn't appealed. It was to get around this court's ruling that that sanctions order is void. And if I may use some colloquial language, I think Morgan has been hell-bent on trying to collect $37,000 in sanctions against my client. He has chased her all the way over to Colorado in bankruptcy court, filed creditors' claims. He's caused her to expend a lot of funds since March 30th, 2017, defending against his efforts to collect a void sanctions order. You wanted a timeline. I can provide it to you. After this court's decision, after the trial court's plenary power expired, which was December 2nd, 2015, Morgan then got a sanctions order on Ms. Hammer. Ms. Hammer filed an appeal. Mr. Sutton was appointed as the receiver. The turnover order comes. All these collection efforts after the trial court lost plenary power.
Of course, there was no superseding of the judgment, right? So, I mean.
Correct.
Under procedure, they were within their rights to pursue turnover until we ruled that the sanction order was void, right?
I'd have to agree with that. March 30th, 2017 was this court's decision. I believe their collection efforts should have ceased, at least until they got properly obtained the reversal of this court, which of course they did not. As far as Elizondo is concerned, it's dispositive, I believe, of this, all of the issues really that are underlying this. There may be a number of issues why the orders entered by the trial court are incorrect or should be reversed, but you don't need to reach any of that because the fundamental issue is the trial court didn't have jurisdiction to enter any of those orders. The Elizondo case did not change Texas law. It reaffirmed the Lehman case, Texas Supreme Court 2001, and the Deredia case, Texas 2010, which simply said if a finality phrase in an order is clear and unequivocal, then the order is final. That's exactly what this court held in its decision of March the 30th, 2017. If Morgan had appealed this court's decision, we would be citing, this court's decision would have been affirmed on this for exactly the same reasons that the Texas Supreme Court entered the Elizondo case. It's the same issue. This court got it right. Elizondo set up, really basically affirmed the analysis of this court. The other ruling in Elizondo, which is the nunc pro tunc issue, the Texas Supreme Court disposed of that in two paragraphs. That is on star 13, page 13 of my printout through Lexis, where the court said a finality phrase is not a clerical error. It can't be deleted after the trial court has already lost its plenary power. The court, as I mentioned, disposed of that issue actually in two paragraphs. It cited Deredia and a case called Dykeman versus Snell, which is a Texas Supreme Court case from 1973. So, the other thing I would like to mention about Elizondo is why it's different from this case, is that Elizondo was not a case where the party lost on appeal and then went to the trial court for a nunc pro tunc seeking to delete language that the Court of Appeals relied on. In Elizondo, the effort to delete the finality phrase all happened in the trial court before the appellate court had decided the case. Here, it's the opposite, and as I've put in a motion for sanctions, which I filed yesterday morning, I believe that is an improper purpose. It violates the rules of appellate procedure. It undercuts this court's jurisdiction. It circumvents this court's judgment. I've cited the law in the motion for sanctions as to why I believe that is improper and that the court has inherent authority to protect its integrity and its jurisdiction and its judgments, but also under the Chapter 10 of the Texas Civil Practice and Remedies Code also applies as substantive law as a secondary source of authority for this court to issue any sanctions, of course, in its discretion if it deems appropriate.
Does the fact that the trial court bit on the argument made and entered the nunc pro tunc undercut your claim for sanctions?
I thought of that actually this morning when I was coming over here, and I have a couple of responses to that. First of all, I think it's important to note that I believe what happened here is Appellee Morgan led the trial court into error, okay? The other point, I don't know that the trial court was even aware that this court's March 30th, 2017 opinion held that sanctions order is void. Morgan was certainly aware of that, and if Morgan did not advise the trial court of this court's judgment, and that he was really asking the trial court to nullify this court's judgment, then that is also a problem. The other thing is, Judge Soifer was deleting a finality phrase in a judgment that had been signed by Judge Phillips on August 18th, 2015. So, I mean, that's the real pernicious thing about Morgan's position, that you can come back after a trial court has lost plenary power, especially if it's a presiding system like you have here in Travis County and like I have in Bexar County. Just wait until you get a different judge, get a different hearing to, and then ask the trial judge, this was really a mistake, wasn't it, Your Honor? Well, that's not the same judge who entered the order. That's what happened in this case.
Well, that wouldn't really happen, would it?
Excuse me?
That wouldn't really happen, would it?
I think that what happened here is there may have been a failure to disclose, maybe a failure of candor with the trial judge in leading the trial judge to enter an order like they did. The other thing is that Morgan's position that you can go back and delete a finality phrase in the trial court after plenary power is gone is, that can't be a clerical error. That can't be correcting a clerical error. It's an atomic bomb on the judicial system because it destroys finality. It would mean that any time you lose in the trial court and lose on appeal, just go back and get a nunc pro tunc to delete the finality and you're back in the trial court. That can't be right. And so I think there it was an improper motion for nunc pro tunc for an improper purpose, and the court has the authority, certainly the authority if it chooses, to impose sanctions. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, sir. Good morning, Mr. Gottfried.
Good morning. May it please the court. My name is David Gottfried, and I represented Wayne Morgan at the trial court and representing him here in this appeal. I'm mindful that the court requires me to focus my argument on the Elizondo case, but as trial counsel and having been in this case for a very, very long time, it's difficult for me to be here and not say at least one sentence about the equities. Given the gamesmanship of Ms. Hammer, as noted in multiple trial court transcripts and by the bankruptcy court up in Denver, overturning Mr. Morgan's sanctions order would be inequitable. I'd like to start by talking about the March 17th, infamous, in our opinion, footnote number 4, which drew into question the validity of Wayne Morgan's sanctions motion.
It didn't draw it into question, it actually declared it void.
I understand, Your Honor. As I read that opinion, what I read was that as a result of the this court lacks jurisdiction to consider the merits of any of the decisions in the underlying case, and that appeal of Ms. Hammer was dismissed for lack for want of jurisdiction. We did not see it as an actual ruling that it was void, and perhaps I misinterpreted it, but in an abundance of caution, we went back to the trial court, and Mr. Rios argued with having the March 2017 order in hand from this court, he argued before Judge Soifer that that a nunc pro tunc was not proper. And Judge Soifer didn't see it that way.
So Judge Soifer was aware of this court's opinion and mandate?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
And who raised that with her? So Mr. Rios did or you did?
I honestly don't recall. I've argued a few hundred motions since then, and I don't recall who argued it, but I'm sure Mr. Rios had to argue it.
But what I'm concerned about is either we have a trial judge ignoring our rulings, or we have a lawyer not having candor with the trial judge in violation of the disciplinary rules.
I understand, Your Honor.
So I'd like to know which one of those it is.
Okay. I'll be happy to go back and get the record and make sure that we're clear on my candor to the court. It's something that I take very seriously. That hearing was argued on both sides.
And the reason this is upsetting, in addition to many other reasons, is as the advisory that Ms. Hammer filed 2 days ago set out, y'all moved for rehearing. You moved to modify the judgment and have the footnote removed. Y'all understood the effect of the footnote. It wasn't a suggestion. Y'all knew what it meant, and you chose not to appeal it to the Supreme Court. You chose to go back to the trial court to go around our ruling. I mean, what about what I'm saying is incorrect?
Your Honor, my understanding that procedurally we had several options. One was to try to take it up to the Supreme Court. One was to try to reform the judgment consistent with what we believe the intentions were on a judgment that I still contend under the Elizondo case and under the Lehman case was not a final judgment. And I would like to have an opportunity to argue that, but I want to answer your question. We had the option of taking it up to the Supreme Court, filing a nunc pro tunc, or filing a bill of review and starting over. The most efficient thing for my client, who has spent tens of thousands of dollars defending a lawsuit filed by Ms. Hammer when she was never in title, she was never on the title to this property. She sued him for conspiracy and fraud with UFCU, folks he's never met. He bought this property in an arm's length transaction, not at the foreclosure sale, but 6 months later when he found it on the MLS. Somehow this woman, who was never on the title to the property and was specifically adjudicated to not have any interest in the property, sued him, filed a list pendens, obstructed his sale of the property. He bought it for the purpose of buying it, improving it, and flipping it, and he was unable to do so because of her list pendens. And it took months and months and months and tens of thousands of dollars in order to right that wrong. And at the end of that case, Judge Crump sanctioned her for that behavior. And Mr. Morgan's due process rights would be violated if he is charged with the duty to appeal an order that he had no notice of the UFC's motion for summary judgment. He had no notice of the entry of that order. He had no notice from the district clerk as required by the rules. And no one, none of the parties or the judges, ever considered that August 2015 order to be a final order because they went on to file 20 motions in the trial court. Some of those motions were filed by Ms. Hammer, a motion for continuance and a motion for new trial. She actively participated in the trial. It was not until March of 2017 that anyone raised the issue that the August 2015 order was the final order in this case. And this case is far different than the Elizondo case. And even
the due process argument was raised on rehearing, wasn't it?
I believe it was. Your Honor, even in the Elizondo case, the Lehman case, the Harris case, and the Duradia case, there's a crucial distinction. In each of those cases, the party challenging the finality of the order was an actual participant in the hearing which gave rise to the order. In fact, in the Duradia case, the author of the order was challenging his own order because he or she did too good of a job making it final, and then came back and said, no, I didn't really mean it. That is not this case. We were in the dark. The record is clear. We were not served with the motion for summary judgment or the notice of hearing or the proposed order or the order that was entered. We learned about it for the first time in that footnote. And to charge Mr. Morgan with the duty to know about that and to challenge it as a final judgment would violate his due process. The thing that I think is important in the Elizondo case is that the court said for 17 years we've been relying on Lehman to mitigate the mischief and chaos of an appeal coming up long after the parties thought it was final. Well, that's not this case. The order that is being argued to be the final order was followed up with 20 different motions and hotly litigated matters in the receivership and the motion for new trial and the motion for sanctions, and none of the receivership orders were challenged. There were 9 orders signed by Judge Laura Livingston as part of the receivership. Clearly, she believed that the sanctions order obtained by Mr. Morgan was the final order.
Well, at that point, till we ruled, it was the it said, in our opinion, made clear both orders had finality language in them.
I agree, Your Honor, and I would like to address the finality orders.
But I want to make sure I'm clear on this. You're not saying Judge Livingston was presented with all the arguments that were made on appeal and then decided herself that the sanctions order was really the final order, not the initial order?
No, I'm not. What I'm pointing out is that the primary concern in the very first paragraph of the Elizondo case, it says the purpose of finality and this sometimes harsh rule is to avoid the chaos and mischief of coming back after everyone thought it was final. But no one thought it was final. Ms. Hammer did not think that the August 2015 order was final because it was never raised as we filed our motion for sanctions, as we filed motions to appoint a receiver. In none of those 20 motions did Ms. Hammer say, hold it, the August 2015 order was final, we shouldn't even be here. So the dangers that are pointed out and as the basis of the Elizondo case, those dangers are not present in this case. Likewise, in this case, what is not present is the language proposed in Lehman, which says a statement like, this judgment finally disposes of all parties and all claims and is appealable. That language is not in the August 2015 order. As confirmed by the Elizondo case, that language in Elizondo, they actually added to that language the Mother Hubbard Clause, which of course states that all relief not granted herein is denied. That language isn't in the August 2015 order. The August 2015 order was an order signed by Judge David Phillips, a retired judge visiting in the district court, unfamiliar with the background of the case and the other claims, and he signed it as an order presented by the UFC lawyer on their motion for summary judgment. The record is very clear that the only thing before that court that day was the motion for summary judgment.
But these were all arguments you could have made to the Texas Supreme Court, right?
Yes, Your Honor, we could have.
About why we were wrong.
Yes, Your Honor.
And we're not saying it was an easy case to decide. Hardly any of our cases are easy to decide. But these are all arguments about why we were wrong in our Court of Appeals judgment. Am I not right on that?
You are correct on that. And that
ship sailed. So really what you should be doing is talking about why you're justified in go getting a nunk-pro-tunk to get around our judgment.
It was not meant to get around the judgment. It was meant to fix a judgment that in the footnote was stated as being void. And it was one of several options, and I suppose we still have the option of the bill of review.
I think participation below might be an issue.
If procedurally we made the wrong choice by filing the nunc pro tunc, my apologies to the court. No one sought to mislead Judge Soifer. I've been practicing law in that courthouse for 25 years, and I intend to practice there as long as I possibly can, and I'm not going to put my reputation on the line there and mislead Judge Soifer. I think Judge Soifer heard everything that went on in this case and believed that in the interest of justice and that clarifying that order to make sure that there was no question about whether or not the August 2015 order was the final judgment or the sanctions order was the final judgment, I think she sought to clarify that.
Thank you, Mr. Gottfried.
Good morning, panel. My name is Patrick Sutton. I was the court-appointed receiver below. I also happen to be an attorney. That's not necessary, as you know, for a receiver, but I'm able to stand here and argue because I wear both hats. Based on the presentations that have gone before, I've changed what I wanted to say. First, I'll share with you an epiphany that I had this morning, which is with reference to the turnover statute itself. It is conceivable that there is a void judgment for Morgan, but nevertheless, the receivership would not be void. There is a valid judgment that awarded $10,000 under that scenario. It's a judgment in UFCU's favor. Now, the party who brought the motion for a receivership happens to be UFCU, but I've dealt with this issue before where one party gets a receivership order and the statute itself doesn't say that a receivership has to only benefit the party that brings a motion. The court has power to appoint a receiver, sua sponte, or without notice. I was appointed. There is at least one judgment that's valid for $10,000. So I think under any scenario, I was obliged to do exactly what I did. Regarding that original turnover order of June of 2016, I did not seek that order. I was not involved at that point. My name was put up as the nominee for the receiver. That order expressly finds that Stacy Hammer owned a property. So Mr. Rios said to you that I was trying to prove she owned it. That's not correct. There's a finding in an order that I was handed which directed me to go sell that property, and that is exactly what I did. And I laid the bricks very carefully in that road. I sought an order for every step of the way. Stacy Hammer and the LLC participated in every step of the way and never appealed anything. Now here we are in 2018, more than a year after the last important order in the case, which was the appellate order, and we have a mandamus petition. Well, that's obviously late. Mandamus petitions, like any other kind of appellate filing, do have a timeliness requirement. In this case, it's equitable. There are all those orders back in 2016. None of them got appealed. The question about, Justice Field, you asked about ownership versus possession. The turnover statute has two components, subparts A and B. Part A, trial court determines who owns something and appoints a receiver. Part B, receiver takes property in the possession and control of the debtor. That first part was the part I was not involved in. The second part is the part that I was involved in. The evidence of possession and control in the trial court over the course of several months and several hearings was never contested with any rebuttal evidence. We have a parade of people on the Hammer and LLC side appearing. They never managed to produce the evidence that Mr. Rios is attempting to produce to you with his oral argument today. So the trial court was making the best decision it could on the evidence it had. Since the only evidence it had was mine, it did not abuse its discretion, and I think the record makes it clear that it considered all this. It did not abuse its discretion in saying, well, the only evidence I have is that she possessed and controlled and, said the trial court, owned it. Well, the trial court had said that in the initial receivership order as well. So at all events, I did what I was supposed to do, and I sold the property and I have proceeds. And so now, Justice Field, to answer your question, the total proceeds were $96,000. And I should tell you the breakout of what has happened. Currently, out of that $96,000 and change, the registry of the court contains $62,700. I hold $18,700. There was an escrow situation that I won't go into that ended up with some money being returned to me directly months later. And then finally, the bankruptcy trustee called me and said, well, you know, I expect you to turn over whatever this cash that you don't contest would be distributed to the LLC or Mr. Hammer, and I did, and that was $19,900, call it $20,000. Indeed, I would have gotten into a great deal of trouble with a bankruptcy judge had I not turned over that money, and I did it the next day. No money has ever been distributed. I am owed expenses that I paid out of pocket that I have never paid myself. all the money is safe. I appreciate that the court entered an order preventing me from distributing, and I didn't mean to fight that order in filing the suggestion of jurisdiction, only to point out that the bankruptcy court is actively deciding these issues. Now, regarding ownership, I got sued in the bankruptcy court in Colorado by the LLC, contending it has ownership of that money. And the LLC fired its lawyer and has abandoned that proceeding. And I have filed for summary judgment on the basis that the LLC isn't represented and I should be able to at least clarify title. Whatever happens up there may or may not bind this court. There is a pot of money. It is owed to somebody. I don't think there's any doubt that some of it's owed to me because I did a lot of work for the court and I need to be paid. The motion for me to be paid my compensation under no scenario is barred. I've given you the authority in our mandamus response, my mandamus response, that the trial court always retains jurisdiction to deal with cost issues and wind up a receivership. These authorities go back almost 100 years. And so at the end of the day, you will decide issues concerning finality. I will be holding money, or the district court will be holding money based on a void receivership, and it will have to get distributed. I actually believe that the receivership is still alive. It's just that I will have to inform the trial court about what has happened and explain that we need to recalibrate where that money is going. So if you void the Morgan judgment, then I will have to talk to you. I'm the receiver. I'm acting for the court. I'm going to say there is a valid judgment, and UFCU may or may not have been paid by now. I'm asking for my compensation, and court, please, here's my recommendation for what to do with the rest.
Where does the sanctions amount fit in with all of that? Is that part of what you're seeking to collect?
I am obliged to collect that, and I have made every effort to do that. I was accused of having continued to do that after the appellate order voiding the receivership, but I haven't done anything except made filings in the bankruptcy court that I think I was obliged to do. I mean, I'm in a tricky position because parties below me are arguing about a whole lot of things, and I have a lot of money. I have obligations to fulfill. And since I do have derived judicial immunity, I say to myself, well, at the end of the day, I'm going to act in good faith to try to argue that the money is still owed to Mr. Moore. Well, I shouldn't say I didn't argue that it was owed to him. I think I was arguing as to my power to do what the district court ordered me to do, which was distribute the money. And so I'm awaiting an order from you or from the bankruptcy court to tell me how to either distribute the money or walk away and get further orders from the district court with money it has to do something with that money directly. So either the district court decides what to do with the money and issues orders, for instance, clerk release money to the following people, or receiver, you distribute money to the following people. I hope I've helped the court. My time is up.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
What do we have by way of rebuttal?
Thank you, Your Honor. Again, Jerry Rios for the relator. Just got a couple of points that I want to touch on. One of them is the gamesmanship issue that was brought up by, I believe, Mr. Gottfried. I represented Stacey Hammer from about the time the motion at issue was filed with the trial court until Ms. Hammer filed bankruptcy in Colorado. I don't represent Ms. Hammer in Colorado or the LLC in Colorado, separate attorneys. I don't believe that there was any gamesmanship. I reviewed everything that was filed beforehand. I think that was a mischaracterization of Ms. Hammer's actions as a pro se litigant. She went through, and I guess I was hired about a week before the response to Mr. Sutton's motion was due, and there were approximately 135 documents, either motions or notices or pleadings filed with the trial court. So there was quite a bit of activity, but I believe that Ms. Hammer was acting to defend herself and to protect her interests at the time. So I just want to make sure that that characterization is explained. Second, I want to make very clear, and I think my brief is clear, that the LLC, my client in this case today, is looking for an order, as Mr. Sutton alluded to, that stipulates that the trial court distribute all the funds from its registry and from Mr. Sutton, whatever he's holding in his own trust account, to my client. Because regardless of the work that was done by Mr. Sutton, and I appreciate that he's done some work, the problem is it should never have happened. And so, therefore, my client is out of its sole property. The only asset that it had has been taken from it and sold. There was no notice that was provided.
Do you agree that any costs Mr. Sutton incurred, though, before our ruling in 2017 would be his?
No, I do not.
And why?
I believe that Mr. Sutton only came on as the receiver after the court had lost its plenary power. And if we have to, as parties, abide by the court order in that respect, then he should have to as well. And
I mean, did anybody raise that with the trial court at the time that the plenary power had expired? I mean, I know we ruled on appeal that that was the case, but in fairness, when the collection proceedings were going, did anyone raise that issue?
Nobody has raised that, and simply because as to the nunk-pro-tunk, there was never, other than the nunk-pro-tunk, I'm sorry, there was never any other argument before the trial court after the ruling was made on March 30th, 2017. And I'm out of time, but I'll take more questions if the court has any questions.
I think that's it.
All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you all very much. The case will be submitted. Court will stand at recess.